Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine, the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We were talking last week about the late 19th century in the towns, and I was making the point that much of the current fabric of British towns, English towns, are in fact 19th century, particularly late 19th century. And I was also saying that in a sense, in order to understand the spatial dynamics of these towns, you really have to go back to the late 19th century, that it was on the late 19th century that people tried to force the motor car, but that in many senses, and you can see it today in cars desperately trying to move along crowded roads, that wasn't a terribly easy process. So what I want to do is to continue our exploration of the late 19th century. And, you know, offer, as indeed is always the case, the interplay of change and continuity. That interplay is not made less pertinent, relevant, or interesting by the fact that it is actually what occurs. And all too often, people only talk in terms of revolutionary change, which tends to be whatever they want, without accepting that there is a powerful sort of weight of the past, and that weight of the past is not necessarily reactionary, it's not necessarily destructive or negative or however people wish to conceptualize it, but is actually part of the very nature of continuity. So I talked about the way in which you see new bodies such as the police forces, or for that matter, the Salvation Army, late 19th century towns. And it's worth drawing attention to the extent that there was an expansion of the middle class. I mean, we're always told, as in history books, that the middle class is rising, and as one historian famously remarked, it never seemed to arrive. I think it's fair to say that in proportionate terms, and also in terms of the change of the political franchise, the second half of the 19th century very much saw sort of prominence of the middle class before, as it were, the rise of the Labour Party in the early 20th century was to take to the fore an explicitly and in some cases aggressively statist working class party. Though, of course, as we know, many Labour leaders were in fact men of wealth and privilege, a practice which continues to the present day. Anyway, going back to the late 19th century, I think it's fair to say that the middle class very much aligned itself with many of the new institutions. For example, the encouragement of the police to, as it were, police the streets, to sort of move away or move along those who were regarded as undesirables, and to push them into the more poverty-stricken areas of the town. That very much matched the kind of social practice that people of the middle class tried to do. Just as incidentally, at the present moment, if you look, for example, at one of the factors affecting public houses in urban areas, it's obviously in part economic change, people being able to buy alcohol from supermarkets, but it also tends to be the case that when licenses come up for renewal, councils tend to be pressed by middle-class people to, in a way, stop what appears to them often to be noisy working-class forums. And the same, you might argue, is what is going on with the discussion around the new government about, in effect, the policing of smoking near pubs. Anyway, there was also in the late 19th century the patronage of a great upsurge in art, in poetry, and in the performance and production of music. So Birmingham, Leeds, Liverpool, Manchester, Newcastle were prominent in a more general foundation of major art collections, not just towns like that. I mean, the Shipley in Gateshead, for example, not generally a very well-known art gallery, but is a late 19th century collection, and with some very impressive works of art. And there was a more general foundation of major art collections and musical institutions, such as the Halle Orchestra in Manchester in 1857. And many of the those institutions from that period still survive to this day. Music halls and theatres were founded, and thanks to railways, there were regular tours of theatrical groups and variety performers, which looked towards the later national patterning of culture seen with the cinema. And again, all of those were preponderantly urban, understandably so. That's where most people lived, and it's also where purchasing power was concentrated, but nevertheless further helping confirm, endorse, whatever phrase you wish to use, the strength of the towns. In addition, civic educational bodies were created, building on the already buoyant practice of launching and joining learned societies. So in other words, this is a case of the continuity I was talking about, early 18th century taken into the 19th century and given a greater prominence and wider membership. In addition, the foundation of universities was very much urban and was located now in major towns. So, for example, the University of Birmingham was established in 1900. It drew heavily on Mason Science College, which was founded in 1880 by Sir Josiah Martin, a self-educated manufacturer of split rings and steel pen nibs, who spent part of his fortune on local orphans as well as on his new foundation, which was designed to be especially useful for local industries. I think, you know, it's as well, though, not to be triumphalist. That's an impressive institution. But it's also worth noting that Queen's College Birmingham hit, which was a different institution, hit financial problems and in 1865 closed due to a lack of students. Or in my own city, Exeter, tertiary education institutions developed as part of the sort of what one might call the Albertine movement, the movement around Prince Albert, as a way of celebrating and advancing a kind of a civic activism focused on education. But despite these developing in the mid-19th century, the University College of the South West was only founded in Exeter in the early 1920s and only gained university status in 1955. So 100 years after the Albertine. I've never used the phrase Albertine before. It sounds rather interesting. Anyway, men such as Martin set the tone of much of urban society, providing a tremendous stimulus to the process of improvement, both civic and moral. Of course, moral improvement being defined by those who thought they were moral. It is ever thus. There was a working class equivalent in the form of cooperatives, friendly societies, which essentially were mutual assistance, sick and burial clubs, the basis of a lot of the modern insurance industry, and schemes through it for improvement through education and temperance. Temperance, of course, not drinking, very much, again, bringing in this idea of moral improvement. And again, interestingly enough, if you wish to think of continuity, you can see it now, although now the background that is offered is a different one of health. It was sort of more, it was health, but a health that was both physical and moral in the mid-19th century. I think now the physical is sort of junk food and the attacks on alcohol, and the moral is attacks on social media. Many other towns saw leisure develop to be an important feature. So, for example, Sandwich in Kent had been a medieval port of consequence. It was hit, in fact, it derives from the Anglo-Saxon period, Sandwich itself. It was hit by the silting up of the harbour, the eventual failure of the cloth industry, the extent of disease, the poor water supply, and indifferent sanitation. Often places near the sea have very poor sanitation because drainage is a big issue. And it languished for most of the 18th and 19th century. But by the 1890s, it was attracting visitors, new residents, notably as a leisure town with golf courses, and one that could be readily reached from London. Rail services to Sandwich began in 1847 and improved in 1881. And that was an instance of the process by which national improvement and standardization especially through transport links and new governmental structures and implementation, also led to new differences between towns. So as I mentioned, Sandwich becomes a leisure town, but there are many other towns on the south coast that do not go in that direction. At the same time, not only were there differences between towns, there were also, understandably and inevitably, many inequalities within them. Women generally worked in low-pay occupations, and attempts to improve their condition met only partial success. So as an aspect of a general process, trade unions cooperated with management in opposing the female woolen workers of Batley and Dewsbury from organising themselves in an 1875 dispute. Definitions of skills favoured men, and skilled women, such as the weavers of Preston and Bolton, were poorly recognised, although women in the pottery industry maintained status and pay despite male opposition. The trade union movement, on the whole, was hostile to women, and that's a fact that it does its best to ignore in its rather curious histories of itself, but it's certainly the case for the late 19th century. Of course, by 1907, women were given the vote in local elections, but in national elections, this didn't follow until 1918, at a time when the male franchise was greatly expanded, and women didn't gain a position of voting equality with men until 1928. Meanwhile, social activities focused on men. So in 1887, there was the celebration of Queen Victoria's Golden Jubilee. In Ashby de la Zouche, the women and the children sat down to a tea of sandwiches, bread and butter and cake in the marketplace, while the men had earlier had a hearty meal of roast beef, mutton, potatoes, plum pudding and beer, which of course had been prepared by the women. I need hardly add that the men did not prepare the confection of sandwiches, bread and butter and cake for the women. Going back to the population change, the urban population of England and Wales, and obviously classification plays a role, but for 1851, that census, it's given as 8.99 million, which was 50.2% of the population, the first census in which the majority of the population lived in towns. By 1911, it had risen to 28.16 million, so over three times the amount in crude figures, and 78.1% in percentage terms. And this was a matter of people living in cramped housing, but there was also an expansion in the area covered by towns, which owed much to commuting by rail and other means. And as a result, the green space between towns, between, for example, Oldham and Rochdale, or between South Shields and Jarrow, or between Birmingham and Wolverhampton, became smaller or disappeared, albeit leaving the legacy sometimes of parkland as a new way to classify and present greenery. Now, the tram systems that reached across these urban areas were frequently run by town councils. In part, they were an aspect of the municipal socialism I mentioned last time, in part in order to cater for the existing distribution of population. But from the 1890s onwards, councils subsidised fares in order to encourage people to move away from the crowded town centres. So in other words, what that means is you subsidise cheaper fares per mile to people that live at the outside of the system, whereas in the central areas, the fare per mile is much higher. So in Bradford, in Leeds, in Sheffield, tramways were built into open country in order to encourage development. The fastest growing urban areas between the censuses of 1891 and 1901 were all suburban. Walthamstow and West Ham near London, King's Norton and Northfield near Birmingham. North of Newcastle, there was an expansion in Jesmond and Gosforth, and I lived between 1983 and 1996 in homes from this period, which were very well built. In total, about 500,000, and both of those homes still exist. So as I've said, this is a classic instance of how the late 19th century town is still there. In total, 500,000 acres of agricultural land was built over between 1893 and 1903. Now, it's difficult if we're looking at the particular impact of any one change to distinguish, for example, widespread urbanisation from other changes of the period is not easy. So there was also industrialisation, politicisation, rapid communications, the decline of hierarchy, deference and traditional social patterns all had an impact, and not least in interaction with each other. But nevertheless, new and newly expanded towns created new living environments in which the rule and role of the old world were far less significant, and the cumulative impact of change recast society. Although, again, and you know, I've already made this point, there was continuities, and I've already made the points about social ones, not least the differential position of women and men. It's also worth bearing in mind that however much towns might be presented, or at least the suburban areas, as new, they also were disturbing for people. The deadliness of towns due to disease and crime was a continuing theme which had been found in the past and still found to the present day. So urban violence in the form of juvenile gangs, such as the Sloggers in Birmingham, the prelude to the Peaky Blinders that have been on the television, or a representation of them on the television, and then the Birmingham Boys, helped make major towns appear dangerous and created fear of a spread of inner town criminality into the neighbouring suburbs. So also with the atmospheric pollution linked to industry, a pollution that rose to an unprecedented extent and provoked much discussion at the time about the nature of the problem and the best solution. The benefit of activity and prosperity played a part in the debate, something that Mr. Miliband seems to be forgetting, our current Environment Secretary, not least in Manchester, which was termed by contemporaries the chimney of the world. Pollution helped produce fog as the modern indistinct, not the mist of a spectral landscape centred on medieval ruins, as in a sort of neo-Gothic novel, but instead a fog that sprang from the burning of coal. In The Truth, The Whole Truth and Nothing But the Truth, published in 1873, the writer Rhoda Broughton referred to London as this great smoky beehive, while in 1888, in London and Paris compared, Henry James praised what he called the magnificent mystifications of London fog, which, according to him, flatters and superfuses, makes everything brown, rich, dim, vague, magnifies distances and minimizes details, confirms the inference of vastness by suggesting that as the great city makes everything, it makes its own system of weather and its own optical laws. Fog provided the cause, means, and evidence of a visual lack of clarity that captured to contemporaries the slippage of sin, with evil and criminality exploiting the resulting possibilities. In Charles Dickens's unfinished novel, and therefore short one, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, published in 1870, the year of his death, Cloisterham, which is modelled on Rochester, which he knew well, has a criminal setting. Fog swirls and the dark is feared. Quote, "Ask the first 100 citizens of Cloisterham met at random in the streets at noon if they believed in ghosts. They would tell you no, but put them to choose at night between these eerie precincts," those near the cathedral, of course, "and the thoroughfare of shops, and you would find that 99 declared for the longer round." London, of course, might build an underground, the first major underground system of railways in the world, but the underworld was deep in the urban as well as the rural psyche. In Bram Stoker's novel Dracula of 1897, evil is on the attack in London, though the latter is also the counterpoise to the evil that takes place in church vaults. Quote, "How humanizing to see the red lighting of the sky beyond the hill and to hear far away the muffled roar that marks the life of a great city." I last read Dracula 2 years ago, but I'm pretty certain that the church vault he is talking about was in Hampstead. And of course, from Hampstead Hill, you could see London then, not as some satanic place, as in a John Martin painting. John Martin, of course, was painting earlier in the 19th century, but rather as the counterpoint to a rural setting, which Hampstead was. The following year, in 1898, there was a hooligan panic, so-called, in London, one linked to concern about robbery, prostitution and disorder in South London. The imperial capital, indeed, troubled many. Today, it's worth pointing out that the legacies of sewerage and transport systems, which made London's rising population easier to service, are in fact a key element of continuation from the Victorians, one indeed that throws light on the limitations of much subsequent governance. At the same time, the changes of the period were scarcely problem-free. Apart from the serious disruption of construction, which Dickens very eloquently wrote about in North London. We're about to see it all over again with HS2 extended to Euston, except I will happily take a bet in bottles of whiskey that actually they would make a worse fist of it today than they did in Dickens's period. But there was also disputes over costs, for example, for water. You know, it's all very well talking about clean water. Somebody had to pay for it. Again, what are we thinking about today? Due to the ambitious nature of public policy, public spending levels in London were higher than elsewhere, at about £232 per 100 inhabitants in 1897 to 98, which was 50% more than in the county boroughs. In particular, London's expenditure on roads and police was greater due largely to the volume of services provided. These days, of course, the Mayor of London has been able to squeeze money out of the general central government, which is one of the reasons why London's bus service is so much better. Prefiguring the present, as well, London's much higher rateable values ensured that the resulting rates per head were lower. More generally, if we're looking at towards the end of the 19th century, whether we're reading Dracula or thinking about hooligans, there was scant sense of confident ease. Of course, the feeling of unease was not specific to towns. There was, in fact, a more widespread anxiety in the 1900s, one seen in the awareness of economic problems, not least in the face of American and German economic and cultural competition, as well as in concern about political extremism, social division, and cultural decay. There was a more general sense of anxiety, one seen in the awareness of economic problems, not least in the face of American and German economic competition, also, in fact, a degree of cultural and political competition, and an unease relating to the sense among particularly liberal unionists, but also liberals, that there was a crisis in society. There was concern about political extremism, social division, and cultural decay. All of these elements have been present for decades, but became more so from the 1890s, although they weren't specific to towns, nevertheless, concern about the town as a whole became stronger. There was an obvious relationship between towns and working class dissidents, notably trade union radicalism, especially in London and the North. Now, it's true some of the radicalism was rural in, for example, mining areas, but nevertheless, the London docks, for example, were a major centre of trouble and therefore anxiety. There was also anxiety about immigration, which Jewish and Chinese immigrants, who caused particular concern, although in fact they were law-abiding, they focused on towns, particularly London, East London and the Docklands. And again, this created a sense of difference that fired anxieties. And I think it's fair to say that these extended to a widespread rejection of the inner town that came to the fore in the 1900s, including in the urban variant of a garden city movement and of suburban villas. So both of those, the sort of suburban villas you see in St John's Wood or Swiss Cottage, and the Garden City movement, Letchworth, are both of them, in a way, an attempt to rebind with the countryside in a reaction against the inner city. In many towns, contrasts between poverty and prosperity were close. And even for London, the detailed maps of 1898 to 1899 of poverty and wealth, the Booth maps produced by Charles Booth, revealed the extent to which there was a close admixture of both. And the same thing is true of the Roundtree maps of York, which I'll be talking about. This, however, didn't preclude there being both geographical tendencies and distinctive areas for both London and other towns. Now, it's true that many of them continued long-standing distribution. So industrial areas were often to the east of a town because across England, like in Scotland, there are prevailing westerly winds, in other words, winds from the west, which blow the resulting pollution and smell away from the west of towns. Furthermore, detailed factors of topography and transport were important, including proximity to canals, railways, docks, and coal supplies. These topographical features could be changed in their impact through the consequences of investment in transport, as indeed remains the case, but they left a legacy on the landscape that affected residential preferences and therefore land prices that in turn sustained such preferences, not least through more attractive housing. I mean, I think it's worth bearing in mind that the 20th century, and I'm sure it's going to be true of the 21st century, was to show that fashionable areas in the converse were far from fixed. It'd been demonstrated by the rise of Islington and Notting Hill, for example, as fashionable areas in London over the last half century. Urban regeneration was not, however, yet, in the late 19th century, a major theme at this point. It was more the expansion of towns that was an issue. Other than in the form of slum clearance, as with the Kingsway scheme in London in 1902 to 1904. The idea of improving existing residences was less to the fore, and certainly far less so than in the last decades of the 20th century. Instead, buying a new attractive villa was on the edge of a town was much more to the fore. Slum clearance reflected the social politics of the 1890s and 1900s. It's true there was an increasing working class voice, notably, but not only through the New Labour Party, because much of the working class voted Liberal or voted Conservative. But the general approach towards those classified as social problems was to see them as lacking views that deserved attention and indeed as incapable of such processes. So we can reconceptualize what I've just said and say those working class people that were affluent enough to have the vote were seen differently to many senses to what was seen as in a way a substratum. And this was central to a harsh perspective, however much it was eased by philanthropy and social ease, the absence of strife. But technology ensured there was no possibility of stasis. The coming force, Mr. Punch's Dream, a cartoon on the 6th of December 1882 in the magazine Punch, produced by John Tenniel, satirised the enthusiasts for electricity, capturing their sense of excitement and the anticipation of new frontiers as an earlier coal-based world of fog, chimney sweeps and coalmen succumbs, as indeed did happen, largely within a century and now completely today. The car was also to bring major change. The first in England, that built by Frederick William Bremer, making its first run on a public highway in December 1894. Cinema popularized new trends, as in fashion. And change was readily apparent. And I think it's at that point that I want to leave the 19th century. We'll move to the beginning of the 20th century next time. But I think if we can, I think what we might say is that we've shown that the 19th century town, particularly the late 19th century town, is very much with us today. But also, ironically, although people might not think it is, many of the issues and problems of that period, gangs, immigration, water supply, pollution, were all present then and are present today. And we shouldn't assume that our solutions, whether palliatives or ambitious new plans, are any more impressive or likely to be any more effective.
Well, that's a great and trenchant summation, Jeremy. I've just a couple of questions, both actually on their own different subjects on a similar theme. The first actually concerns slum clearance, and I just wanted a little bit more detail on the process there. So slum clearance would be enforced by local government or through statutory provisions from Westminster, which would be applied by local governments? Would there be compensation paid to the landlords who own the properties being cleared? What was the process?
Well, I mean, it varied quite considerably. And as you correctly say, subsequent legislation, which I'll be coming to next time, expanded the role of central government in it. Initially, it is largely a matter of the individual municipality, which means that, of course, a key element is the new London County Council, because, as you know, in the 1880s, you get the formation of the county boroughs who take on new roles, including if you like, slum clearance. They don't call it slum clearance. And the London version of that is the London County Council. So the LCC very much is an area of strain between ambitions to improve the environment and concern about costs. And that also overlaps with, and again, echoes of the modern day, tension between the LCC and the individual constituent boroughs. The LCC might say that it wishes to replace an area and put in a new road. That's the easiest way to do slum clearance, is to say you've got to put in a new road. And Kingsway is a classic example because it's broad and wide and linked at the bottom end to the Aldwych. So you've got a lot. They cleared out a big slum there. But so that's the easy way to do it. But of course, people didn't necessarily like being cleared out. And I make that point in, I published a few years ago, A History of London. And I made that point that slum clearance, which prior to that in the century, the major instances had been in many senses with railway works, railway terminals. So late 19th century, Marylebone, for example, part of that is built on a slum. In a way, you know, that had been able to be presented as a kind of inevitability. Money changed hands in the sense that the landlords got money. I mean, bear in mind, most people in poor areas didn't own where they lived. They were just tenants. So they were then just turfed out.
And just a final question, again, on the subject, the relationship between public and private, particularly with reference to what became Birmingham University. You mentioned Mason College. I was wondering, in this period leading up to the creation of what we now call the red brick universities, the civic universities, some of the colleges which became foundations for these universities, Mason being a case in point, these were entirely private philanthropy institutions set up by a wealthy person or persons with money, to which people would then pay fees to attend, or what was their relationship to the civic structure of government in which they were based?
Oh no, I mean there was an enormous variation. If you're looking at Exeter, there are a number of institutions of higher education develop, most of which the town council plays a role in. There is often a mixture of private and public. So how can that operate? Let me give you an instance. You can have the town council put up some money for the original thing. You could have it provide some property. You could have it agree to improve the roads and pavements in the area. You could have it say that it is going to put in money in order to have the training of teachers for the new so-called board schools, board of education schools, and that will be the reason. So, for example, if you take the University College of the Southwest, which I mentioned, I think I'm right. Again, I'd have to look up my notes, but I think I'm right in saying that in the 1920s and 30s, a quarter of the students there were doing education degrees, and education was the largest subject across the country as a whole. What was that due to? That was because local authorities were putting up the money because they wanted teachers. So, in fact, the University College of the Southwest, the four counties of Cornwall, Devon, Dorset, and Somerset put up the money for that. Now, obviously, public roles in the sense of the Privy Council are required if you're going to get a degree granting sort of criteria. But most people initially for tertiary education are not reading for a degree in that sense. What they're doing is a vocational course, and in effect, there is a difference between, but it's often an overlap, between somebody who provides a course for free because they're a philanthropist and somebody that provides a similar course or set of courses because they're aiming, you know, an improvement college, as it were, because they're aiming to make money from them.
Well, Professor Jeremy Black, fascinating as ever. Thank you for taking us through the history of the Victorian town in a period of both improvement and a sense of threat. Thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.